The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 4th of February 2020. On the podcast today, Alan Green talks about Team 17. We argue over Metro Bank. I think it's a flawed business model. Alan Green thinks he's a good punt. I don't think he should punt. We also have Open Orphan. We both like that. And we also touch on Plarium Imaging. We didn't have much time there. Plus, also, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent, now the author of The Crypto Trader. We cover this week's Bitcoin news and just general stuff, you know, in the market. We're both investors, so we're both talking lots of rubbish. But check that out. And also, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You're Al.
Very good morning from sunny Seaford, Just. How are you?
Not too bad. Had a weekend in London. We're at the Shard. Took the missus up the Shard.
you don't want to say that to too many people, you know?
Yeah. But it's very impressive, actually, the Shard. I've never been up there before, and very impressive. I didn't realize it's high level security on the way in. It's like an airport, you know. You're going through security screens, everything. It's phenomenal.
It's funny you should say that, because I was with my son on Saturday, and because his wife was at an event with the rest of our family, and she works there. She works in digital. They have an office up there. She's up there 2 days a week, and she said, "You must come up sometime, because the great thing is," she said, "obviously you go through security, but once you come in with us, then we can go up and do all the bits and pieces free of charge." So I too will be going there myself very shortly. But I mean, she says it is airport security there. Obviously, it's incredibly carefully screened, and you know, your bags have gone through, your personal effects have gone through, everything, and yeah, that's what you've got to do if you want to go to the Shard.
Do you know what I just saw? Do you know the most visited tourist attraction in the world? Do you know what it is?
It's probably the London Eye, isn't it?
No. It's quite annoying, because it's the Eiffel Tower, the most in the world, the most visited, and of course it's France. And of course France, you know, beat England on the weekend in rugby, and now they're beating us on the most visited tourist. But I think I've been at the Eiffel Tower and the Shard. I think the Shard's better than the Eiffel Tower. I know the Eiffel Tower's older and it's got some, you know, iconic look about it, but I didn't feel safe at the Eiffel Tower. A couple of times I've been up there and I thought, this is easily open to a terrorist attack, and one leg of that thing falls over, you're gone.
It's a bit sketchy, isn't it? I went up the Eiffel Tower some years ago, and when you're sort of up there, you can actually feel it moving around a bit in the wind sometimes. It's a bit unnerving, but as you say, it's a very old sort of tourist attraction. Been there for many years. But I will be going up the Shard, I will be going there from the point of view of somebody that has family that works in the office there, so I would get a free tour. Looking forward to it.
It's a very interesting story. I just read about a bit about the history of it, and the guy who's a Jewish London guy who sort of started off in a glove factory, basically. Who, you know, his parents have brought up, he's working very working class in the rag trade there. He became a property developer. He built his way up from having, you know, a stall, basically. So he died a while back. I can't think of his name now. But he set up a property company, and he died about 4 years back. But he was worth $220 million. But he was the guy who got it together, bought the land, and then got Qatar involved, because Qatar basically own it now. But he went to Berlin to meet an Italian architect called Renzo Piano. And Renzo Piano, basically, he told him about the idea, and Renzo Piano sketched something on the back of a handkerchief or napkin. And he said, I imagine this coming out of the Thames, you know, this spiky sort of thing. Like this. And that's how it started. But that was in 1998. It took 10 years to get planning for it. And then it's done. But what's looking
into? Yeah, I think architecturally it still divides opinion, but I think it's...
I like it. I think it looks lovely. I think it stands out, you know?
I do too. I think it's left an indelible impression, sort of, on the London skyline, and it's part of the it's a real landmark tourist attraction there now. And I think at first it was a bit radical, but it is really something else. And I often come into London Bridge Station anyway, so of course you walk right under it, right through it. So it's excellent.
I'm just looking at, right now as I'm chatting, I'm scanning between two different Vanguard funds for emerging markets, because of course the Chinese market went down 9%, bounced back up to 8%. I've got some exposure to copper long term. I've not gone in mad on it, but I think copper of the long term is a good play. So I've bought some copper and I'm sort of scaling into that on a monthly basis. But I'm also looking at emerging markets because I just think we'll come out of the back of this. China's now pumping in a stimulus into the economy, and I just think, of course, everything, the markets, when you go, apparently, I've never been to university, I started, I just dropped out, but if you go for studying economics, study that the markets are an efficient model, and they're not, they never are, and that's why people make money. You make money because the markets overpriced, because the market is just a collective, human endeavor. Everyone's, it's based on emotion. So
it's buyers and sellers on each side. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And it oversells or overbuys both ways. And so it's not efficient. In fact, it's very inefficient. I mean, it hits efficiency now and again, but what is efficiency? But then again, so times like this, when we have this coronavirus going out, we don't know the depth of it yet. But like I said, last couple of days, they're sort of stabilizing, the total death count is stabilizing, and I just think it'll bounce back from this, and I think now's the time to take advantage.
But I took a look at some charts over the weekend of the behaviour of the S&P 500 and the US markets during the SARS virus in 2002-2003, which was much more serious and far more potentially destructive than the coronavirus, which is basically an offshoot of that. And it does come, they believe it comes from eating flesh of animals, in particular, of course, the Chinese sort of eat bats and other rodents and other bizarre creatures, but they believe it comes from that. But SARS in 2002-2003 was far more destructive, and in the run-up to the immediate reaction was that the markets fell somewhat, but once they'd gone through the initial fall, as it stabilized, as they got the infection under control, the markets just came right back and pushed ahead, and that didn't ignore it, but it was all but ignored. And I think if this follows the same pattern, if this is brought under control quickly, and I mean, you look at the progress the Chinese are making on that hospital in Wuhan, it's astonishing. I mean, this thing is going up, they said 5 days originally, but it's now going up in 10 days, but it's already half built. And I mean, you just see this time-lapse camera, and there's this swarm of ants across the site just building this incredible hospital. So you know, they are getting to grips with it. As you said earlier, there's a huge financial stimulus gone into the market, and the indices didn't fall as much as had been feared, and on the back of that, I think we're seeing a cautious response from European markets at the open this morning, and I think US futures are marginally ahead at the moment as we speak. So it follows the same course as the SARS virus. It may be that the worst is already in. But of course, given there's much more exposure, given that there's a lot more news out about how people who are infected are turning up and dying in the Philippines and turning up in Germany and various other places. Obviously, it's got to play out. But one sense is that perhaps they're starting to get to grips with it.
Hopefully, well, it's I found a fund I quite like here. It's Vanguard. It's got 37% exposure to, the portfolio there's exposed, 34% exposed to China, 11% to Korea, 11% to Taiwan, India, 8%, Brazil, and they've got South Africa and Russia, but it's mainly just, the majority is Far East, so I quite like that. And I go for that, and I buy some of that today. Ron, let's talk about individual stocks. What do you reckon? What's going on here?
Okay, got four stocks I want to talk about today. First of all, we spoke about this company, first spoke about it in September last year when the stock was trading about £2.60, £2.70. Team 17 Team 17 Group, TM17 is the epic code. This is a niche video games developer. It's a video games label, creative developer, and it provides a platform for indie developers. That's you know, talented youngsters and young and teams of programmers can basically use the Team 17 platform to publish. They have over 100 titles, well-known titles in the gaming industry, and the company basically is sort of run by the CEO and founder, a lady called Debbie Beswick, and they're based up.
Debbie Beswick,
lad.
Look at the share price on that. Wow, that has done very well, hasn't it?
Well, it has. You know, if you bought when we first spoke about it last year, it's now trading at £5.15, so it's doubled in price. When we first spoke about it last year, the interims were, you know, really strong. Revenues are up 97%, gross profit 119%, EBITDA up 145%, and this is growth all the way through. They have a big war chest. They don't have any debt, so they're using this war chest to make acquisitions. And in January, they announced the acquisition of Yippee Entertainment, fantastic name, for $1.7 million, half cash, half shares. So they've used the war chest and obviously used their shares as collateral. They then published a trading statement where they said, and this is on the back or after the strong September interims last year, where they say they expect earnings and revenues to beat expectations in the current year. They're seeing incredibly strong growth in multiplayer games. The results are due on March the 10th. There's a raft of broker upgrades over the past few months, but all of them are behind the share price. So this company is burgeoning. So we might be at a stage at the moment where we're traveling ahead of the curve, as it were. But even so, I think you can't ignore the growth in revenue, EBITDA, the fact this company has no debt. It's just it's strong growth. It's a British company run by the founder and CEO, and this one seems to just keep on delivering. Yeah, you might want to take a view and wait until the results on March the 10th. But I think the writing's on the wall there. I think the results are going to be pretty good. So if they carry on like this, and if they carry on making these careful acquisitions, who knows where it could be? Having said that, the company's worth $676 million, so you might it's a fairly racy valuation. But the share price and the share price action tells its own story.
Yeah, I mean, you are paying for that growth, so definitely there, because, like I said, half-year revenues were $30 million, so let's say they do a bit more than that, but they say it's 66, say that's 10 times revenue already, so that's, you know, that's not talking about profit. That is quite sorry. I'll wait. I'll see what the results are. I think it's flying towards the results, and it'll we'll probably see, you know, 10 million profit though. So, you know, 60 times that. Well, no, in fact, 20. So 30 times. Well, PE 30 is not that bad. But it's always when something flies like this, it's just worth waiting for the results, because you know, everything's flying towards that results on that really, and it's you know, rising towards it. It'll probably have a bit of a comeback and a consolidation after that. So in my mind, I'd wait.
Yeah, I think so. I think as well, often with these companies, the trend is your friend. And obviously, as you grow, as your revenues grow, your profit grows, your war chest grows, you can then start to, if you can expand that model and deliver exponential growth, then actually you can, the growth rate can accelerate. So perhaps that's why we're seeing this incredible reaction in the share price. But even so, you know, put it on your watch list. I think this company is worth following. And if there is a dip off, you might want to find out why there's a dip off. But I think at some point,
sometimes you need a breather. When it's, you know, if you look at the RSI on the chart there, the RSI is at there are no companies I've seen the 87 the RSI is at. Now above 70 is overbought, but sometimes you need to go above that to get it moving. But I wouldn't buy anything up there. If you look at the last few times it's gone up there, it's consolidated and come back for a while. So
exactly,
it's going to happen now. It's going to come back a little bit, and then the time is scaling. But I do like it. I like the growth they got there, and it's, you know, normally they're big for me market cap wise. But I'm starting to go up the market cap spectrum size now, because I'm finding sometimes I can't take a definite, you know, a decent enough size in the smaller caps, because if you want to sell, sometimes you can't get a quote, or you know, so it's a hard book getting out as well. So I'm going to go. I'm going to go up the market cap size, and yeah, I like the look of this. The fair play. Look at the growth there. See, revenues increased 97%, gross profit up 119%. That is very impressive.
Strong set of numbers, very strong set of numbers. But actually,
you're paying for that,
You are, lad, you are. But but Canny Northern's there, Canny Northern's at work. But I think, yeah, that's the thing. You know, if for example, Debbie decided to retire, or there was a change of management, those are sort of factors that could disproportionately affect the share price, because you know you've got the same team there running this company, growing this company. It's all clover. But in those situations, sometimes you find when the CEO steps aside, you know, it could all change and the company could go in a different direction, and then you might see a sharp fall. So you've got to bear all these factors in mind, but clearly that growth is not to be ignored.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. What's next, Al?
Okay, so we've sparred about this one in the past, just, but I'm going to bring it up again. And again, we're talking in run up to results. Results in February 2020, a few weeks away, for Metrobank, MTRO. And of course, since Vernon Hill stepped down last year, Vernon Hill, of course, is the brilliant CEO that founded Metrobank with his Yorkshire Terrier, and you know, the company or the bank grew, and then there was an accounting error last year, which basically forced the bank to refinance, and there was a bond with a hefty coupon, which the company's going to have to pay out every quarter, which is going to eat into its profits. What we do know is that October last year, deposits grew by $500 million to $14.5 billion. Strong quarter three account growth, and Sir Michael Snyder came in as chairman to replace Vernon Hill. Since that time, there's been very little news. There've been a number of sort of analysts publishing sort of views about it. Align Research, we may not want to talk about Align, but one company in particular. One company in particular said that it's 0.28 of book value, and this, you know, the shares are worth sort of £4 to £5. When you come to Metrobank, when you come to the issues that it's gone through, clearly how long is a piece of string? But considering the stock was trading at some £40 a year or so ago, then there's got to be value somewhere along the way. So what's happened since then? CEO Craig Donaldson stepped down at the end of last year. Then the announcement after that, Sally Clark, the former senior auditor of Barclays, has come in as non-exec on the board. So we're seeing something of a steadying of the ship. There's been no clue, no news, no updates from the bank since that time. So we're waiting now until the results in February 2020, which of course is a few weeks away. The stock has obviously dipped as low as 155 on the year. It's been as high as £15 on the current year. Currently trading at £2.25, it seemed to stick around £2 for a long time. So clearly, with the movement in recent weeks has seen the stock pushing to the upside, and there may be some expectation from full year results, from numbers, and also maybe news on the restructuring too. But very much a work in progress. Still a very risky play. I will declare I do still hold stock in Metrobank, because I do think they're going to find their way out of this. But it's not for widows and orphans, this one. And I think you have to be very aware that this could go either way. So anyway, Metrobank, a few weeks away from its full year results.
Yeah, I think it'll dip on that. I don't think any metric will be any good. I mean, even the last set wasn't that good, but they tried to sort of cloud the issue a little bit. But I think this one will be, they'll be proper losing money now. So, do you know what? Yeah, of course, there's potential there. They've got enough, they're not skint, but they're losing money. The business model isn't working as is. And the regulatory environment is too challenging for challenging banks. And I think they've got an issue here. I don't know what they're going to do. They need some. Ironically, they'll probably need one of the big four to take them over, or some other group to help them out, because they can't do it on their own. But there we are. I don't think it'll work.
I agree, but I'd also say, I think when you've got somebody the caliber of Michael Snyder joining as chairman, and then
but you know what Buffett says about people and businesses. You know, when it's the thing about when good management join a bad business, it's usually the latter that is reputation stays intact. You know, so the bad business continues, and the management end up getting trashed a bit, because if it's a bad business, it's not like you can do this. You can't do anything. The metrics are wrong. Interest rates are at all time low, so that the margins they've got are tiny. They're paying hand over fist for new customers, and they're making a loss on them. So it doesn't make any sense. They've got areas in the country that. It's just bricks and mortar. That's a slowing market, even though they're trying to sort of champion that. It's all wrong. They got debt that's going to be costing them about 80 million a year when that second bond kicks in next year. They've made nowhere near that ever in profits. So they're just, if you look at the basics of the business, it's not good. And they've got to change radically. And until they do that, I won't even look at them now. So
it's got a tier one capital ratio of nearly 17%.
I don't disagree with all that. I don't disagree. What I'm saying is,
the peer group.
But it doesn't matter. The reason, it doesn't matter. If you're losing money, it's not a viable business. They're losing money, and it's getting worse.
The thing is, if they're losing money, they can restructure to take that into account. But clearly, that's not.
Well, how? Because they need the money for the bond for regulation purposes. So they need that money. The buffer they need costs them too much money. They can't maintain that.
They need the money to pay for the coupon, sure, on the bond. But the fact is that they're still expanding. They open new branches.
It's cost them to acquire these, and they're not paying off. The margins are going down, and they are paying hand over fist to acquire these customers, and they're not making the money. It's a blown up model. The model isn't working. It's flawed. So we'll see when the figures come out. Anyway, we'll look at the figures and we can argue the toss then. Because I'll be astonished if they've improved in any way. The only way they're going to improve, and they keep saying this, is that they're getting more customers. It doesn't matter that the customers they're not making money of the customers.
Well, the thing is,
bigger liability.
I was in in one of the businesses I'm involved in. We have an account with Metro Bank, and I was in Metro Bank in Eastbourne the other day, and it was pretty full.
I don't care about the branch in Eastbourne being full. So, look at the balance sheet on the I don't care how many people are in the bank. I don't care how many old fuddy duddies are in the bank. You're sitting down having a chat with the bank manager. We're talking about millions of loss here.
Is the model working? Yes, people are coming to the bank. Yes, people.
No, it's not.
But
if you're looking at Eastbourne and you're saying, is the model working, and you're judging it off one branch, that's...
They had to refinance, okay? They had to refinance last year, so that was...
No, but Alan, if you're judging Metro Bank in its entirety just from the branch in Eastbourne, or any one branch, that you have a couple of people, old people in there, do a sort of accounts, that's not going to make up for the 21 million loss they're going to make last year. The couple of old fuddy-duddy biddies going around, oh, it's nice to have a proper bank manager. Lovely. Getting a purse out. Can you deposit 45 pence, please, in the account?
It was full of young people. Eastbourne's changed, Jess. You should come down sometime. but my point is that they hit the buffers last year. They've refinanced. Clearly, there's a heavy coupon on that refinancing. But as they're going forward, they bought some people of real caliber into the business. And people have reputations too. And being an auditor of former auditor of Barclays, you're not going to go into a position unless that could tarnish your reputation. For the rest of your career. So there's a consideration there.
Thing
too.
Is, but, you would if you were any good. You wouldn't go to Metro. If you're Barclays, you'd go. You'd improve yourself. You're trying to better for yourself. Now they're probably paying them a big chunk of money, but you wouldn't settle for a bank that is doing badly. You'd stick with a sort of brand that people know of. That's a step downwards, not a step upwards. Anyway, let's move on. We've got 5 minutes, Al. 5 minutes. Come on.
Okay. Open orphan. So.
Yes.
So we've. I won't go into what Open Orphan do because we've discussed it many times over the past the past few weeks. But Open Orphan completed the acquisition of HVivo last week. At the same time, well, at the end of the acquisition, also raised $5.2 million in cash. And once again, Cal Friel, the who's now moved to exec chairman, obviously Trevor Phillips, the CEO of HVivo, is now CEO of the group. Cal Phillips, through his company Raglan Capital, underwrote that placing by with $2.5 million of his own money. So this is a man that has skin in the game. Over the weekend, the Sunday Times featured an article on Open Orphan, and that the article basically looked at HVivo founder Professor John Oxford, and the fact that HVivo have at St Mary's Hospital in London one of the largest quarantine centres in Northern Europe. There are 24 beds at St Mary's Hospital, and with this expertise, they are well placed to deal with any upsurge in coronavirus or any travellers that come back that possibly have been infected. This is a centre that can be used. So Professor John Oxford has also been quoted on the BBC, the LBC, and numerous other channels over the past few days, and he's a well-known authority on epidemics and how to deal with them. And given that Open Orphan have just completed this acquisition, it's timely is probably the word we should use than fortuitous. But clearly the coronavirus epidemic and emergency have come together with HVivo's facilities and the completion of that acquisition, bring it under one roof. Really looking at the group now, the shares of Open Orphan have just been trading just above 6p and have continued to do so with a market cap of 27 million. But once the funds that were raised at the fundraising, those will be used. Once those funds are used to complete the pipeline of sales that are lined up at HVivo, and of course through other channels as well, I think we're going to see significant impact on the bottom line. Probably, in the first part of the year, and we will see a substantial revaluation following that. But significant progress over the weekend, and obviously on the back of the epidemic in China.
Yeah, no, I like Cahill, I like what he's doing there, and I think it may take a bit of time. I think there may be someone suggesting maybe a seller in there somewhere, but once that's clear, I think this company is undervalued, and he's very genuinely excited about what he's created here. Okay, anything else, Al? Because we've got 2 minutes.
Okay, no, that's it. That's it for me. Just let's leave it there. There's I've got plenty more to talk about, but not stuff we can cover in 2 minutes.
Lovely. Okay. Well, you were going to mention Plarium, wasn't you? I quite like the fact that John Alice, Dr. John Alice, the non-executive director, is now chairman.
Yeah.
And well, what I like about that, is he bought a truckload of shares recently.
Well, he bought another £98,000 worth of shares at 29.6p, right at the top. And of course, the company announced a few days later that it detailed the positive clinical phase 3 trials, and it revealed from that the visual data from lung infections that it was focused on. It revealed new data that hasn't hitherto been visible on MRI scans, so it's brought a new dimension to treating severe lung disease. So a big step forward for Plarium. Again, we discussed Plarium in the past, so I'm not going to go into details about that, but yeah, highly significant. Of course, John Alice bought shares when we first spoke about this last year, 200,000 of shares. And now he's chairman, and he's just bought another 98,000 worth of shares at the top of the recent press.
Yeah, exactly. And he knows his stuff because he was in GE. Of course, he was at a spin out, like you say, a spin out that was sold for $450 million, and that was 10 times the initial investment value. And in fact, Richard Hullahan came on the podcast on Friday, I think it was Friday or Thursday, and said you know, Plarium has a wider application than that company that you sold $450 million. So we can see the potential there. You know, it's a lot of potential.
Yes,
marvellous. Cheers for Al. Sorry, we're out of time. And we'll speak to you next weeky.
Speak to you next weeky. Cheers, mate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, the crypto trader. You're right, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm all right, you know. I'm still annoyed from, like, I just told you from Sunday where I deleted a video. Because what I normally do was I cover news, you know. I use, what's it called, PowerPoint, not PowerPoint, some, what's a key, I can't speak. Keynote. I use Keynote to create, you know, a workflow that I'll be referring to in my video. Then I download that into a PDF kind of thing. Then I start recording. And then on the Sunday I did this. I was a bit rushed because me and the wife went to London. We had a weekend out there. Went to the Shard and we had a sort of Prosecco and all that stuff. So I came back on the Sunday and I started doing the video and I wasn't organised at all. And my computer said I needed more space. So I deleted lots of old videos and the bin in which they went into. Realize I actually deleted the video I just created, which is annoying because it's several hours of work going into that, you know. So, and I tried to download some software so you can recover your bin. Didn't really work. I thought I wasted even more time trying to recover it. And so, a lesson learned though, next time, delete stuff before you start creating a video, and then it's all fine. Just workflow stuff. Still annoyed a little bit about it, you know. But
I say try not to empty your bin immediately after you've deleted things. I mean, I know you didn't have any choice in this case because you were running out of space on your hard drive, but generally I leave it a week after I've deleted a bunch of stuff until I empty the bin, because sometimes you just realise, oh no, I've deleted something by mistake. Then you can undo it.
Well, sometimes you need lessons like this, don't you, to learn, you know, just to remind you, think, oh, remember last time, you know, if just, otherwise you don't learn, so there we are.
You need harsh lessons.
I find that with stock market, you know, and I think it's the most effective way of learning is it's a very good way of learning, because what everyone wants to do in the stock market is make money. That's exactly what they're doing. If you get it wrong,
I agree,
it hits you right in the pocket. Exactly what you start losing money. That's exactly what you didn't want to do. That's the opposite of what you wanted to do. I wanted to make money. The market's taking money away from me. What's going on? So either you learn quickly or you're out of the game. And that's
why quite often when I speak to budding traders, What I find is that if they have early success, if they have beginner's luck, and they don't learn those lessons that you're talking about there, they can get very overconfident. And then whilst they might be, you know, showing off to me that, wow, I've clearly got a natural knack for this, I've been making loads of money, you know, this can go on for weeks or even months. Mm-hmm. But then sooner or later, because they haven't learned various valuable lessons, sooner or later they make an enormous error and generally lose the lot. You know, their entire accounts, blow up their accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to be. I mean, the first lesson you should always learn is I did a series of videos is about exposure, you know, and I always say that because you only expose yourself maximum 10% to one stock, maximum that is. So, it doesn't mean you have to go up to that, but that's maximum. Then you have lots of bites of the cherry, you know. If you just, because I know people, I did a video recently and a guy said, I said maximum 10%, and this guy said, well, I think that's too much, you know, because I said, yeah, but listen, my audience are small cap investors or traders, and I know some of those basically full on exposure to one high risk oil and gas play. And I think it's ridiculous. Absolutely.
That's insane.
I know. It's like putting all your money on a non favorite horse, you know? So I'm trying to convince people. Because I did say, listen, I think if you're a part time investor, if you've got a job, a proper job, and you're trying to make some money on the side of investing, I think you should have your percentage age in funds, diversified funds, and the rest you can dabble around a bit with individual stocks because they're high risk. Funds, you know, more diversified, low cost funds. And you don't get rich quickly, but you build up wealth over a long period of time, and that's the way to do it. But then, if you want to try and sort of earn a bit faster, a bit more high risk, chance of high reward, then go into individual stocks. But in the meantime, have that fund as a backbone of your portfolio. You know? And he said, No, you need more than that, more than your age and percent. I said, yeah, but you're talking to an audience here. I'm talking to. I know people have said to me they've got all their money in one stock. I think, are you nuts or what? But there we are.
So you're just trying to convince people to do something even vaguely sensible.
De-risk, yes. I mean, de-risk. I mean, how old are you, Glenn, now?
I don't like to discuss such things. Nobody asks
shouldn't
a lady.
Shouldn't ask a lady, isn't it? Come on, Glenda. How old are you?
Look, I'm early middle age, okay? Let's just leave it at that.
You're not going to... just doesn't matter. Just say how old you are. No one cares.
No, I don't like the sound.
What are you talking about? I've always been wary of people, blokes especially, who don't tell me their age. Always been very wary. To me, it shows a lack of transparency, a lack of integrity, lack of honesty. Come
Look,
on, Glenn.
Everybody has their Achilles heel, okay? You know, I'm very open about 55. A lot of stuff in my life that people are, no, I'm much younger than that.
I'm only joking.
I know.
I'd say you were 40.
Yeah, I'm about 40.
But just say then, 44.
Oh, just stop it, all right?
Higher or lower?
I'll happily tell you off air.
Higher or lower?
To announce to everybody.
Higher
exactly
or lower, Glenn? Glenn, higher or lower? 44. What do you say? Higher? Lower?
Guess what? Look, people can work it out from Wikipedia or whatever, probably.
So, well, why don't you just tell us?
Yeah,
I don't want to go online.
Glenn,
listen. No one really cares. How old are you? Just tell me.
All right, I'm 46.
46? Go, you're old. Go, you know, do you know what? Generally, because you've got a nice round head, I think it stretches your wrinkles, and you're looking quite good for your age. I'd say 42. Isn't it? 40, 42. It's looking quite good there.
To be honest with you, that's one of the reasons I don't like to tell people my age, because generally, I've always been one of those people who looks a lot younger than they are, even when I was a teenager or even a kid.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like to kind of take advantage of that. I quite like the ambiguity, and lots of people I speak to think I'm in my 30s, and I don't want to disabuse them of that pleasant notion, you know.
Either way, it's fine. You say 40 people. You get a compliment from that.
Privilege. It's kind of like white privilege, but I have like youth privilege. Ruined it.
Yeah, but people compliment you. Say, "Wow, you look good for your age, Glenn." It's my book. You should read my book. Just anything goes back to selling the book. Yes, it's all down to the book. Yeah, there's a section in there.
It's a secret.
It's a hidden section in there about how to keep you looking youthful in life.
How old are you? You got to tell me.
I'm 49.
You're 49. I thought you were considerably younger than that.
I'm 49 this month. I'm 49 this month.
More than your.
Let's congratulate each other. How young we look. but listen,
Justin,
I know.
Yeah. A slip of a boy.
So what is it? In fact, there's a long way of saying. So if you're, you know, if you got a proper job and you're investing on the side, for you, Glenn, let's bring that. You're obviously a professional, but I'm saying if you had a job doing something else, I would say 46%. Of your money should be in funds, safe sort of, you know, some a couple of funds, like a dividend, high dividend fund, like a diversified fund across all markets, you know, so a couple of those, and then the rest of the money you can mess around with individual stocks. But again, even with those stocks, I'd say, you know, say most of them should be cash generative, you know, profit generating companies rather than sort of high risk, loss making oil and gas or whatever. So yeah, I think people who come into this game take on far too much risk, and you know, it's like trying to conduct a brain surgery without having no experience whatsoever. And people think they can do it, you know. It takes a long time to learn it, and so yeah, I think just play it safe, because you can always, you know, if you do well over like 5-10 years of investing, you can always up the risk. But if you start off badly and lose a lot of money, that's it then. It's game over. So take your time in the markets, you know. It's enjoyable. First and foremost, I always quite looking for a good business, you know. That's what I like about it. Rather than owning a business, some of the business I own, I hate to actually run the business. I find it very boring to do the same thing. But I think what's good is you actually invest in all different kinds of businesses, you know, and you get a bit of knowledge by reading up on them. And I quite like that, you know.
Yeah, I agree. You don't need to sell them the idea of investing to me. I'm sold.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, let's look at Bitcoin. What's happening in Bitcoin this week?
Bitcoin. As we speak, and you know, it's always a problem, because when you put out the podcast later today, things might have changed.
Yeah.
But at this point in time, it's looking a little bit shaky, I got to say, because we've had a sideways movement that's gone on for about a week now, and it's what us chartists tend to call, well, first of all, it looked like a head and shoulders, then it looked like a double top. Either way, it was looking a little bit unpleasant and bearish, and indeed it's now kind of falling. it's falling right now. Which I don't like. Yeah. But nonetheless, it's not plummeting, which is always a good sign. There's clearly a fair amount of buying support there as well. So we remain in the sort of medium term uptrend that has been going on since pretty much the beginning of the year. I bought into Bitcoin at about the beginning of the year on a little breakout from that kind of sideways pattern that had been going on since November. I bought then. It's been going up by fits and starts ever since. And what's happening right now, hopefully, will just be another mini downward wave in that kind of larger upward movement.
Yeah. It's a good job you said fits and starts properly. You got that wrong way around in the beginning of the year. But listen, do you know what? I just think though that we got that support level, it broke out at 8,800 pretty much, or 8,900 pretty much. That way, try to get above about three or four times, broke above that. So that's a nice bit of support there. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, so like I said, we've had those 3 days where it went from 83 all the way up to 93. And then, of course, it went down next day, up the next day. So now it's consolidating a little bit, isn't it? It's got to consolidate a bit. So, you know, let the steam come off it a little bit. And then,
So far, it doesn't look like a big deal, exactly. I mean, you've got to remember that from the very, the sort of most recent bottom, which was the 25th of November, the price was about $6,500 per Bitcoin. And as of yesterday, it was at about $9,500 per Bitcoin. So that's a pretty massive rise.
Well, do you know what?
A couple of months, 50% rise.
Yeah, exactly. And do you know what? If you look back now, what's happening right now? You've got the 50-day moving average, right? These are moving averages, which is a probability here. So yeah. if you look at the 50-day moving average, it's now kissing the 125 moving day average. The 20-day moving average is crossing the 200-day moving average. Last time that happened was literally back in March, April 2019, when it shot up and started, came out of that bearish market it was in for a while, and then shot up from like $4,600. Over the next couple of months, they went up to close to sort of $13,000. So it's looking quite good because this is a start of a change in trend, but it doesn't mean it won't come back a little bit and consolidate. And in fact, this rise now seems a bit more sustainable because it's had a couple of pullbacks and the way it hasn't gone stratospheric within a couple of months like that time back.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point. And it's, as you say, the moving averages, the 50 and the 100-day moving averages are more or less crossing each other now. And that's that's a nice confirmatory sign. It's not necessarily predictive, but it's always nice to see when those two, when the 50 and the 100 cross each other like that, it usually presages a very positive period. Well, I mean, of course, those are lagging indicators. So they're basically just saying the market's been going up for a while now. And so here we are, these averages finally catching up and crossing each other. But nonetheless, trends tend to persist, which is how trend followers like me make our money. Trends tend to persist. And therefore, when you see the 50 and the 100 day crossing, that generally means you're going to have a lot more upside. Not always, but usually.
Yeah. What is there any sort of fundamental news about Bitcoin or crypto out this week that you think is quite significant in some way?
Well, I've been quite focused on studying China's new digital currency that is very close to completing by the looks of things, because more details have been trickling out from China about the nature of this cryptocurrency. And it's, to be honest, I'm terrified but also excited at the same time by what they're creating here, because America seems absolutely blasé. It's just astonishing. The American government doesn't seem to care or particularly notice that China is on the verge of creating the world's first major digital currency, which will allow them to A, scrap notes and coins completely, and B, have complete control, if they so desire, over everybody's spending and everybody's transactions. They'll be able to see every single tiny little financial movement that anybody, any of the billion people in the entire country make at any point in time. And they'll be able to use extremely clever monetary instruments. At the moment, when governments want to use monetary policy, they just have to use a kind of blunt interest rate, don't they? Oh, we're going to take interest rates down 0.25% or 0.5%, and usually that doesn't really have any impact whatsoever, or very, very little. But when they have a digital currency and no notes and coins at all, and all money is being tracked in real time by the government, they'll be able to use very, very clever monetary instruments to expand money supply, to contract money supply, like fine-tuning of the economy, and also, of course, complete surveillance over everything that all their citizens are doing.
Yeah, and do you know what? When you put it like that, right? It's amazing, because initially they were resistant, weren't they, to cryptocurrencies and exchanges. And then somebody obviously pointed out to President Xi, said, do you know you can have complete control over all monetary policy with a digital currency? And they said, what? We can have more control? I thought it was less control.
Exactly,
so no,
Bitcoin
more control. They okay, well, let's.
So there would be less.
Yeah. Let's do
but
it there. Let's.
The irony is,
I know. Yeah. And do you know what? It's almost like if central bank has got their head around that, they probably adopt digital currencies a lot faster because they realise they can have more control. And then, but then again, like I said, Bitcoin is the decentralised coin that I think. I just genuinely, if every central bank has their own sort of digital currency, I think it'll help Bitcoin because. It'll be like the American dollar, I think. Bitcoin will be that individual, that independent sort of, sort of benchmark, and which people sort of exchange in and out of around the world, and that'll be the sort of the safe currency.
I hope so. I mean, I am concerned that countries like China.
So how far are China off?
China makes very, very. China's making very, very positive noises about its own currency, like it's almost there. But we're expecting it to be launched sometime this year. Put it that way. They're already in the sort of pilot.
They're quite busy at the moment, aren't they?
Testing it. They are, actually, good point.
Building hospitals and, fighting coronavirus, which is... I've become obsessed with coronavirus. Just the numbers. I've got a spreadsheet. Every day I release a spreadsheet on the update, on the new thing. Where is it goodbye? So I release one a day. I tweet it out every day. Because I just want to see. I took it... this week, I bought copper. I think it was maybe last week, actually, by a copper ETF. I've also just bought an emerging markets ETF, which is 34% of that Vanguard fund. 34% is directly exposed to China, because I just think it's majorly oversold. And, even if it takes a year, it'll bounce nicely. But copper has, after 12 days being sold off, copper, straight down 12 days. It hasn't done that for a long time. It's now on the second day
it's
rising.
2011, I think I read somewhere.
Yeah, so it's now just bounced from, it was like 22 on the RSI, and now it's just bounced to like 31, so it's bounced upwards. So I think it'll correct a little bit. And if you look at, even today's policies, about EVs, the UK, I don't know if you've seen this, they're now bringing it forward by 5 years. They're going to ban the sale of petrol, diesel and hybrid.
Yeah, I saw that.
By 2035.
Really soon, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the thing is, this is the thing. That's why, I mean, copper to me is a long-term place. When you do a big oversell like this, it's massive, because electric vehicles use about four times as much copper as a normal, petrol-powered car. There'll be more than 20 million EV charging points by 2030, consuming about 250% more copper in 2019. Than in 2019, because by 2030. And so we can't keep up with it. We need lots of copper. I mean, in the cars and all the cabling, all the charging points, everything needs more copper. So sooner or later, I just see it as a long-term story, a very good one. And I see the emerging markets long-term story. There are good companies there. And I see at the moment, we're getting that typical market inefficiency, where everyone's told about the markets are efficient. They're not. They oversell, they overbuy. And at the moment, it's overselling. But I release this spreadsheet every morning to see, what if the deaths are coming down. As yet, they're still creeping up. Like, I think it was there's 425 deaths now, as death toll is at. That's 60, up 64 from yesterday. Where was I yesterday? It was 57 yesterday. So they are creeping up still. But I think once that starts coming down, then I think we've seen the bottom of uncertainty, and I think things will start to rally. It will have a hit on the impact on the economy of China, but I just think everything oversells. That's what the markets do. They oversell, don't they? And overbuy as well,
True, but when something's oversold, it can get a lot more oversold.
Yeah, that's
because
what,
we've had a
that's
time
scaling.
Bounce.
Yeah, scaling.
Copper,
So I always scale it. I never sort of chuck everything in one go. So I've set up this fund, for example, copper at the moment is 1% of my portfolio, but I've set up direct debit and I will be buying copper, so it'll average out over the long term, because I see.
Are you not worried though that this could be, the big collapse? We haven't had a big collapse for a decade or so, and there are some pretty ominous signs at the moment.
I'm happy with that. I'm 33% cash in my portfolio. I've got my exposure to every company I've got three companies that are just around my 10%. Most of the company's exposure 2.5%. So, I mean, I've got plenty of cash, and I've got longer-term funds and dividend-paying funds, so which pay more, you know, when shares go down. So I'm fine. I'm ready for it. Bring it on. Bring it on. Some bargains. I've got cash for bargains. I want to buy good companies. At the moment, I'm looking at lots of good companies, right? You know, generating good revenue, good profits, but yeah. They're just rallied too hard, and I don't, you know, they're literally overvalued. So I want to see a good sort of sell off, so I can pick up some bargains. Generally, you know.
Well, I am a little bit scared because we don't know what's going to happen with this virus. So as you know, I've been hedging. I talked about how I bought put options, in effect an insurance policy against the market falling, the American market specifically, and so I'm still. I'm still doing quite well on that, even though the market's recovering. So basically, I've been kind of flat, effectively, for the past couple of weeks. All the ups and downs in the American market have balanced out the shareholdings I have with the insurance policy I have. And so I'm more or less kind of taking a neutral view on that, though I'm also long, or I have been long on gold for a while. I'm very long on treasury bonds. I've got a lot of those, American treasury bonds, which have been doing well while the market hasn't been doing well. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking a pretty cautious stance right now.
No, I think mainly because of
what you're talking about. Well, mainly because of, for two reasons. One, coronavirus, and two, because the market has just risen so fast, particularly the American stock market in the past few months. And like you, I just kind of feel like it's all getting a bit overheated.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, this coronavirus, I'm looking here on spreadsheets, 2.0 on the figures today or from yesterday. 2.08% of fatalities from cases, you know, reported. So that's not huge. So 98% of people are surviving this, you know. I think those 2% have health conditions and issues, or they're old. So I don't think it's something we can't deal with. It's just the moment we haven't got a vaccine for it, that's the problem. So people talk about flu. And people keep missing the point. People say 60,000 people die from flu every year. Yes, but we have a vaccine for flu, and most of the people that die are old or have health complications, so it's not a problem. You can get, you know, inoculated against flu. With this at the moment, you can't, and that's the worry, that's the uncertainty. And so whether you like it or not, the Chinese economy is something like, I think, 17 times as big as it was when SARS was around, you know, and all that. So the impact on global growth is more significant now. So like China, as I said, several cities are shut down and nothing's happening there. That will have an impact on flights, on travel, so their economy will slow. The demand is less. I mean, there's construction sites shut down, everything. Commodity prices are softening because there's less demand at the moment. That's the problem. It's a knock-on effect. So regardless, it's not about how dangerous this virus is, because it's not that dangerous. 2% of people, you know, die, 98% survive. So it's just about the economic impact is what's going to happen, you know. And so it will, because China's the fastest growing big economy in the world, you know. So that's the worry, really. But
yeah. It really is. And but also, you know, even if only 2% of people die, which is great. Well, great compared
which
to...
Which is great. which is great.
Let's please edit that out of the podcast. Yeah, yeah.
No, I'll leave that right in. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It's
Ebola, I suppose. How I'm looking at it.
So we understand it's not great. We just realise that, you know, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, exactly. It's not an extremely deadly virus, but nonetheless, what worries me is how easily it spreads, and of course that it spreads while it's symptomless in the very early stages. Let's take a real worst case scenario. If it were like the Spanish flu or something like that from the 1920s or 1918 rather, then, you know, imagine it infected a billion people, for example. That would mean, if there was a 2% death rate, that would be 20 million people dying. So even though it's only 2%, still the potential is there for it to absolutely wreak havoc. So it still terrifies me. And, you know, it's spread all over the world already. And it only takes a few of those countries to be absolutely useless at containing it for it to spread throughout their country. And then there'll be no stopping it unless we ban all flights all over the world.
Did you see that bus driver who was like, you know, the British, Chinese, you know, people who live in China, and they've been flown home, you know? and yeah. they were sitting in quarantine. And they were driven to the quarantine by a bus driver. And he was a typical bus driver. He's probably up from up north, actually. He was there, right, middle-aged guy, bit of a belly. His shirt on, was tie on, but, you know, top collar button undone. And his sleeves were rolled up on his shirt. He had tattoos. And he didn't have a mask on. Everyone on the bus had a mask on. He didn't. He was driving the bus. The coach, don't bother me. I'm too hard for that nonsense. He's like, literally, he did not care. He was driving the coach and he didn't even have a mask on.
I guess if everyone else has got a mask on, then he doesn't need one because they can't spread it.
I don't think he was thinking that cleverly. I thought he just thought, you know, hardy northerner, doesn't care really. Who cares? Yeah. I've had worse than that, son. I should tell you that now. Really,
you know, yeah, worse than Corona.
You spend Christmas Eve in Newcastle with that. I don't know the accent here. Without a coat on, it's a lot worse than coronavirus. I thought, isn't he nuts or what? If I was on duty and I was asked to be the bus driver, I'd say, are you kidding? So, you pay me a couple of million, maybe I'll get on there in a special suit. But I'm not driving that bus unless you pay me death money, you know, literally. Would you do that? I wouldn't do it.
No, I guess I wouldn't. But like you say, it's sort of, I don't know. I mean, it's his job, isn't it? He'd probably lose his job, wouldn't he, if he just refused to drive the bus?
Hang on, you lose your life or lose your job. Sonny, I just say, listen, I'll get another job. When I apply for another job, I'm sure they'll understand that I didn't want to drive a bus full of people who are dying, who was got airborne human-to-human disease. I'm sure they understand that, so we accept that, yes. Look at my track record, it's very good, but when it comes to driving a bus full of people who could kill me, I'm not that good. You know, I'll probably call in the sickie on that day. Anything else worth chatting about, Glenn, or was that it, really?
I mean, there are things, Justin, as ever, but no, let's not.
Oh, I mean, there's one thing. What's the thought on halving? Let me ask you a question this. I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I bet you won't know this, okay?
What?
If Bitcoin doesn't rise significantly before or afterwards, right?
Yeah, after the halving.
Yeah, will that be bullish or bearish for other cryptocurrencies?
Because he has a bearing on other cryptocurrencies.
No, I tell you why I said that, because I still hold some, you know, Argo blockchain mining, and they do got well. They came up with an update today, which is very good. They've basically mined more than half of the coins in January than they did for the entire last quarter of last year. They've upped their mining machines, their efficiency is getting better, and obviously the average price has gone up, so they've done quite well. But obviously, as halving comes, they'll have less rewards after that happens. Now, the guy said, it doesn't bother me because it can mine anything. It doesn't have to be Bitcoin. I said, yes, but if Bitcoin doesn't rise on this halving, what will be the effect on other cryptocurrencies? Will they go down, you know, or in disappointment, sentiment, you know, or will they rise because other people start mining those coins? Because I'm assuming not only will Argo flip to another cryptocurrency, other miners will probably go to other cryptocurrencies as well. So that may push up their price, you know. What's the other one? What's the next sort of two or three biggest ones that can be mined, really? Ethereum, I suppose, is that?
Yeah, you've got Litecoin, you've got Bitcoin Cash, of course, the alternative to Bitcoin, which is also very strong. Chainlink, that I've talked about before.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose it may be bullish then for the other, do you think, or not? It could be.
I don't know if it'll have a bearing. I mean, you know, I've been sceptical about the importance of this halving all the way along anyway. I've studied the stock-to-flow model and the various things that people use to justify the idea that the price of Bitcoin is going to rocket after the halving, but...
But no, there's generally an adjustment time, isn't there? It's generally sort of it doesn't happen straight away. It takes about several months as an adjustment until some of the miners drop out because they can't do it efficiently. And then it starts to rise again then, if you look at the chart. So everyone thinks it's going to happen.
It's just absolutely rubbish. Yeah. I mean, that theory is just nonsense. Somebody just made that up. They were like, because they looked at 2016, the last time there was a halving, and they noticed, well, you can't fail to notice, that the price of Bitcoin simply didn't rise for several months. In fact, it fell to 3 months before it started rising back to where it had been before the halving. Whereas in the previous halving in 2012, the price rocketed immediately. So that was where the original theory came from. The price rocketed immediately. That was the first ever halving, bear in mind. So it's not like there's a whole history of these things happening and the price always rockets. The first halving, the price rocketed and everybody went, oh, look, whenever there's a halving, the price is going to rocket. But then in 2016, the price didn't rocket. So then they make up this theory that, oh, there's a delay because, you know, miners take time to drop out of the market and so on. But they don't take time anyway. Miners switch off their machines immediately if it is no longer financial.
Well, I don't know. I was told by a miner. I don't know. I was told by a miner it takes a while for people to sort of.
Well, it takes a while for them to go out of business. Doesn't take them a while to stop mining, you know, because they're just computers. Mining is just you turn on your computer and you set the program going, and then you just switch it off again. So, so in that sense, it's an immediate thing. Though, if they're talking about companies actually,
no,
going
but, what, out, but the thing is that
again, that does take time.
The thing is, all miners have a different level of break-even level. So. You, of course, will get some that are efficient, some are not. So you get people switching off at different levels. That's the thing, isn't it? So yeah. I think when you get to a certain level, I mean, you get a lot more people switching off. Say some people are still profitable. What's the average? Is it something like 7,000, 8,000? So once you get below 7,000, people can't keep doing it. They think, oh, switch off. But there's quite a few efficient below that. So there'll still be a certain amount. But I mean,
yeah.
If you halve the rewards, of course, now, then that's the equivalent. Let's say we're at 9,000. That's the equivalent of 4,500. So it's like the very few people are efficient at that level. So a lot will just switch off. And then hopefully lack of supply maybe will just go nuts again, the share price, the price of Bitcoin. Who knows? Let's wait and see. It's all exciting. Something to look forward to. Will you be having a halving party then?
I will not. I'm going to be the party pooper. And even if I get invited to a halving party, I'm not going to go. Or if I do go, I'm going to just bore everybody by telling them the price isn't probably going to react to this halving like I've just been telling you. Mm-hmm. Just to kind of put the kibosh on the whole party.
I think what you should do is have a halving party, but say it's from, you know, say it's from say 7 till 12, but people have to leave halfway through. Just go with the theme there.
The beautiful thing about this theory, of course, is that if the price doesn't rise, then I'll be vindicated after the halving. But if the price does rise, I'll be able to say, well, it was just a coincidence. It was in an upward trend anyway. Of course it was going to rise. So, it's a win-win for me.
Lovely. It's a perfect trade. Win-win. No risk, just reward. Lovely stuff, Glenn. Speak to you next week-y.
All right, see ya.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Andalas Energy, change of management there. At four, Eurasia Mining. At three, Union Jack Oil. At two, it is Open Orphan. And number one most followed company is Argo Blockchain Mining. Let's go to the RNSs. And at number five is SafeStay. Trading statement, that was yesterday, of course, last 24 hours, most liked. At four, Solar Oil, proposed transaction and reverse takeover update. At three, Rock Rose Energy, acquisition of 100% interest in the cotton field. At two, Jangada Mines, direct their share purchase. And number one, most liked RNS, is Argo Blockchain Mining, and that's as a January operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.